Thanks for downloading and listening to the Celtic Underground podcast during these troubled times. I hope that you are all well, staying safe, keeping your social distance, and not at work, where it, or obeying the rules wherever you are in the world, let's put it that way. So we are on the verge of something special with nine in a row, but of course this won't be the first nine in a row. Celtic were the first team in Scotland to do nine in a row back after the arrival of Jock Stein, starting with the 65-66 season. So this is the Nine in a Row Chronicles, and we are going to be taking you through year by year the nine in a row period right up through, with a bonus episode at the end. So let's give you some context to this. 1965, the summer of 65 is when the nine in a row started. The top films in 1965 were Sound of Music, Dr. Zhivago, Thunderball, Those Magnificent Men in the Flying Machines, That Darn Cat, No, Me Neither, The Great Race, Cat Ballou, What's New Pussycat, Shenandoah, No, Me Neither, it's a western apparently, Von Ryan's Express, Our Man Flint, The Greatest Story Ever Told, right the way through. In the charts, well, the season began with I Got You, Babe by Sonny and Cher at number one. Actually, the League Cup sections began with Help by the Beatles at number one, but that's why I Got You, Babe by Sonny and Cher is playing in the background. And the top grossing film in the US prior to Celtic clinching the title, or by the time Celtic had clinched the title, was The Russians Are Coming. Yeah, Me Neither. And the number one single at the end of that season was Pretty Flamingo by Manfred Mann. Anyway, enough of me setting the scene for season 65-66. We'll do more of that in the podcast with Robert and St. Anthony. So I will say goodbye from me, and this is Robert, and this is St. Anthony. I got you to walk with me. I got you to talk with me. So we are now going to start our Nine in a Row Chronicles by starting with the first set of Nine in a Row. And I'm joined by two people far more better placed than I am to talk about it. That's Robert and St. Anthony. How you doing, guys?
Great, Harry. Good to be
very
here.
Very well, Harry.
Faring up through the lockdown. We had no milk, so I wasn't panic buying. We had no milk this morning, first morning of the lockdown, so I was up at 8 o'clock. I was very pleased to see that there was milk on the shelves and people were only buying stuff out of baskets. There was no panic buying, so hopefully that continues.
Good show.
Right, so we're going to start with the first nine in a row, 65-66 season. So we need to set the scene. Jock Stein had just come back to Celtic as manager. Ted Heath had just been elected Prime Minister in the UK. So, Robert, do you want to give a bit of an overview of where Celtic were going into this season?
Well, I think Stein had come back in March 65 with great credentials after the work that he'd done at Dunfermline. And also at Hibs, so not just winning the Scottish Cup with Dunfermline, some amazing results in Europe against high-quality teams. Celtic had been underachieving for decades. So in the 20 years leading up to Stein's appointment, we'd won the league once in 1954 when Jock Stein was captain, and we'd only even come second once. So although the honours were being shared around amongst the clubs, and there was good Hearts teams and Hibs teams, you know, we were definitely not picking up our share of trophies. And I think when Stein came back, it, you know, gave great hope to the fans and indeed to a lot of the players who were on the staff who had remembered Jock Stein from his time as the reserve team coach. And it didn't start particularly well. I was just having a look at some of the results. I mean, we only won three out of Jock's first nine games in charge in the league. But clearly, you know, in 65, we won the Scottish Cup, and, you know, we hadn't won anything since you know, since beating Rangers 7-1 in 1957. So the fact that we won a trophy so quickly after Jock Stein came back, I think, was brilliant for, you know, the players' confidence and morale, and gave the fans great hope. So, you know, I'm sure we went into the 65-66 season with renewed confidence. And after a period in which Rangers had been quite dominant, Rangers had won the treble as recently as 1964, and Celtic generally were faring very badly in Old Firm games during that Jim Baxter era.
So, the teams, for those who don't remember pre-Premier League, it was an 18-team top flight. The teams in it were Celtic, Rangers, Kilmarnock, Dunfermline, Dundee United, Hibs, Hearts, Aberdeen, Dundee, Falkirk, Clyde, Partick Thistle, Motherwell, St Johnson, Stirling Albion, St Mirren, Morton and Hamilton Academicals. Stephen, do you want to, or St Anthony, I should say, do you want to sort of give an overview as to your thoughts on the start of that period?
Yeah, I used to be fascinated talking to my dad and his friends about the for me, Celtic really started when Jock Stein took over. Sounds awful to say it, but when I was a wee boy, if it was before 1965, I didn't show a great deal of interest, because it was only from the Stein era onwards that sort of grabbed my attention. And I grew up in the 9-in-a-row era, for example. I was born in 66, so I was 9 years old the first time we lost a league championship. But the one thing I always remember my dad and his friends saying was that Jock Stein made several changes to the team which weren't particularly noticeable, made a big difference. And the first thing everybody talks about is how he brought Bobby Murdoch back from being an inside forward to being a world-class right half, what we would call in the modern age a central midfield player. And Bobby getting into that position gave Celtic a new dimension. Another thing that they always said as well is that signing Joe McBride was a masterstroke, because Joe was fairly highly rated, but he'd been about a few clubs, and we were getting Joe McBride at his peak. And the way that Celtic played at that point, it was geared to making chances for Joe, and the goals he scored were phenomenal between 1965 and 1966 when he got his injury. And the other thing as well is that players who were pretty nondescript, like Bobby Lennox, for example, was pretty mediocre by all accounts. And yet when Jock Stein came back, Celtic began to play to Bobby Lennox's strength by using his pace. So he didn't, apart from McBride, he didn't really make a great change in terms of the players coming in and out. But what he did do is he had a look at what he had and he made better use of him.
And one of the things about that, Robert, was Jock Stein was only Celtic's only fourth manager, but in many ways he's considered Celtic's first proper manager, because he was considered the first manager who actually had full control over the team.
That's right. And I think it was one of the conditions upon which he took the job in the first place. I think a lot of stories which emerged later suggested that Sean Fallon was Bob Kelly's assistant, or Bob Kelly's preference to become the manager after Jimmy McGrory, even though Stein had reported. And I think Big Jock took the job on the basis that he was going to be in control of all football matters. And, you know, thank God that was the case. And, you know, things might have turned out very, very differently, you know, without a doubt. I mean, I would echo what St Anthony's just said. You know, just looking at the stats for Joe McBride, you know, he scored 81 goals in less than 1.5 seasons before that Christmas 66 injury. And, I mean, I consider Joe McBride to be one of the four truly great signings that Jock Stein made, bearing in mind that, you know, in those days, you know, you signed a couple of players a year, unlike, you know, what Tony Mowbray would have signed in a window, which was probably about a dozen players. So, you know, I think Joe McBride, phenomenal striker. I mean, the others I put in that super signing category, Willie Wallace, Harry Hood and Dixie Deans, you know, we paid money for them all. They all came up good in games against Rangers, big cup games, big European nights. And, you know, I'm sure some listeners will think, yeah, forgotten X, Y, and Z, who were also great signings. But I think those four strikers were critical to the nine in a row achievement and all the other successes of the Jock Stein era.
So, Stephen, I mean, as I say, none of the three of us, Robert has got memories of the following season. None of the three of us are at this season. So the sort of key things from this season that we can talk about is we actually lost the first game against Rangers in the season. We did well in Europe. We did well in the League Cup, not our favourite competition, and obviously the league title. So, St Andrew, you take me through some of the key points of the season for you.
I'll tell you something. Excuse me. It's a personal anecdote my dad told me. That was a pre-season game just before the season started. Celtic went down to Sunderland to Roker Park. Now, Jim Baxter had just signed for Sunderland for a huge amount of money. And it was a big publicity signing. Sunderland also had Harry Hood at the time, amongst many other fine players. And this was seen as quite a test for Celtic going down there. My dad was in the pub at night. He didn't have the exposure that we've got these days to media. So this would have been probably during the Glasgow Fair, and he was in the pub early evening, and these two guys came in with Celtic scarves. And my dad thought, oh God, the game was on the day. And he says, listen, boys, what was the score? And the two boys said, 5-0. Oh, gee, that's quite a setback, you know, getting beat 5-0. And, you know, I thought we were moving forward here. And the two guys went, what are you talking about? Celtic won 5-0. Even though Baxter was playing. Apparently Baxter couldn't keep up with him that day. He was puffing out his arse by the end of the game. And my dad always said that was the first indication that this team was going places, that you could go down to a proven English club and not just beat them, but give them an absolute pounding. And it was quite humiliating for Jim Baxter, I think, because obviously with the Rangers connection, he wouldn't have wanted to have been in the sore end of a 5-0 defeat. So at that point, Celtic fans were very optimistic, and you're right to say there we did lose the first Old Firm game in the league, but the other game I think that's done in folklore is the 65 Cup final, whereby had we lost that one, then the momentum that Jock Stein had started might have been stalled. And the other crazy thing to think about is that we actually get two penalties in the one game against Rangers from an FA in a cup final. So the momentum by the autumn of 1965, that there's plenty of momentum there and really going forward.
Yeah, because... Yeah, sorry, carry on, Robert.
Sorry, I was going to say, Harry, I do have three very vivid memories of that season.
Okay.
But none of them were very good. I mean, I remember England winning the World Cup vividly, so the least said about that, the better. But I also remember vividly us losing the second leg against Liverpool in the Cup Winners' Cup semi-final and going out unluckily, and there was a lot of crowd trouble at the game. And we ended up missing out on a final against Borussia Dortmund, which was taking place at Hampden in 1966. And that would have been a nice home game for us and could have been our first European trophy 12 months ahead of Lisbon. And even worse than that, I remember losing the replay of the Scottish Cup final when we battered Rangers, but Kaya Hansen got the only goal of the game. So all in all, three bad memories, three bad moments, and what was otherwise a very good season, and frankly could have been our first treble in our history. We got two legs of the treble and very unlucky to lose to Rangers in the Scottish Cup final after the replay.
In fact, could have been a quadruple because you mentioned the Cup Winners' Cup semi-final against Liverpool, And I've not seen it, but Bobby Lennox with 5 minutes to go at Anfield. Bobby Lennox scored a goal, which would have put Celtic through on away goals. But I'm lifting this from Wikipedia, Celtic Wiki. It was controversially ruled offside.
Yes.
So whether it was...
Just one wee thing there to say, Harry, about the there wasn't any away goals in the days. It would have been a replay.
Well, it would have been a replay, that's it, yeah.
I would have went to a third game in a neutral country, but it'd still have been interesting if that happened.
So it could have been the quadruple. So if we go through the tournaments in order, so the first tournament was the League Cup. So that was in the old-fashioned group stages. We were in a group with Motherwell, Dundee and Dundee United. We won 4 and lost 2. Saint, do you remember when the group stages finished from the League Cup? Because I can remember going to group stages. I mean, I know they've got group stages at the moment, but not en masse group stages. Do you remember when they
finished? No, the last group stage was 76-77, but they brought it back, I think, for one season. For two seasons, rather, in the early 80s. But we started getting ties against Aloe Athletic and Arbroath that were basically getting crowds of less than 10,000. So that was scrapped and they went back to the short, sharp knockout phase that they enjoy at the moment.
Yeah, so...
I think the beauty of the old sections, as it was in the 60s and 70s for a long time, is that there was no seeding. And, you know, we had the joy of knocking Rangers out, and only one team went through from each of the 8 groups, and I think we knocked out Rangers maybe 3 times in 4 years in the in the Steam era, which was a hell of a way to start the season with, you know, old Burn games at the beginning of August. But I remember the League Cup section, the season we signed Willie Gardner, which must have been early 80s, and we lost our first 2 matches against St Mirren and St Johnson, and poor Willie, I think, got OGs and maybe both of them and didn't fare too well.
I remember being at that, yeah. Thinking, who's this star guy they've signed who scored OGs? But you're right about the group stages, because if you look at it, we were in with Motherwell, Dundee and Dundee United, who were all top flight teams. I mean, Dundee United, I think, ended up that season finishing 4th. Rangers were in with Hearts, Aberdeen and Clyde, who, again, all top flight teams. Yet if I scroll down to another section, 3rd Lanark, Berwick Rangers, Cowdenbeath and Hamilton Accies. Now, Hamilton Accies were the only top flight team in that section, and they finished bottom of it. And 3rd Lanark won the section. So it just showed you how completely all over the place the group stages were. So we went through the group stages, and then we played Raith Rovers, who we won 8-1 away from home and 4-0 at home to beat them 12-1 in aggregate. And then we're through to Hibs in the semi-finals, where we drew 2 each at Celtic Park.
Ibrox.
Ibrox, yeah. Oh, that's right, it was a replay. That's right, it was semi-finals at Ibrox, and we drew 2 each, and it was a replay.
We should really touch upon that game, because that was a one of the games, I think, we scored with the last kick of the ball to get a replay. And again, it's another indication of how the momentum might have stalled if we hadn't got through into the final against Rangers. Apparently, Hibs played very well that night, and I think Celtic stole a draw, to be honest. But in the second game, they got their form back and gave Hibs a doing and won 4-0.
The cup final was on the 23rd of October, 65. The attendance at the cup final at Hampden was 107,609. The Celtic team, if anybody wants to talk me through, if either of you two want to interject and talk me through these positions, okay, because I'm going to read the team with the positions. Goalkeeper Ronnie Simpson, fullback Ian Young, fullback Tommy Gemmell, right half Bobby Murdoch, centre half Billy McNeil, left half John Clark, right wing Jimmy Johnson, inside forward Charlie Gallagher, centre forward Joe McBride, inside forward Bobby Lennox, left wing John Hughes.
The one thing I would say there is that I know you're reading it out in order, and that there's people there who might think that it's a rigid system, but I think from what I can gather that Jock Stein became very flexible with that system. It became a 4-2-4, probably the first of the modern age numerical tactic formations, whereby you've got an orthodox back four, you've got Murdoch and Auld in the middle of the park, and you have two wingers and two strikers. But it's a very flexible thing, because Bobby Lennox can play in different positions, John Hughes can play in different positions, and even Jimmy Johnson was known to wander about from position to position. But the one thing about that game that comes across from a historical point of view when you read about it is that was the first time really that Celtic had fought fire with fire against Rangers. Rangers were a very physical team, and the feeling for Celtic fans at that period was that Celtic didn't have the strength to stand up to them, and also that the Robert Kelly used to frown upon Celtic players getting involved in any physical confrontation on the park. But Jock Stein had made it clear before that game to the players that he was looking for 100% effort in every aspect. And the one I think that is worth pointing out is that Ian Young basically done Willie Johnson very early on in the game to set the tone that we're not going to mess about here. That this isn't the old Celtic who play for the game's sake. This is the new professional Celtic who will fight fire with fire. And I think Rangers were taken aback that day by the aggression that Celtic showed.
I think it's also the game when Celtic were doing a lap of honour with a cup at the end, the lap of honour was abandoned because Rangers fans invaded the field, and there was no laps of honour at Hampden after these cup finals, or an Old Firm cup final, for many, many years after that. And I think the point about the tactics that St Anthony just mentioned, and I think the style that Jock Stein quite quickly imposed upon Celtic was sort of going against the trends of football at the time, because, you know, a team like Inter Milan had won a couple of European Cups. Helenio Herrera, famously with his negative tactics, was having great success against teams like Benfica, Real Madrid, winning European Cup finals. You know, Alf Ramsey had come along with his wingless wonders. And it was the first time, I think, we'd really seen a strong trend towards defensive football. And, you know, Jock came along and, you know, just turned what had been a pretty inconsistent bunch into, you know, an unstoppable goal-scoring machine that season and most other seasons while he was there.
The thing, if I compare, so the season before Celtic had lost 2-1 in the League Cup final to Rangers, and the team in the League Cup final the season before was Fallon, Young, Gemmell, Clark, Cushley, Kennedy, Johnson, Murdoch, Chalmers, Divers, Hughes. Not a massive difference. Obviously, the goalkeeper, Ronnie Simpson, Billy McNeil coming in. So, not a huge... Point being, the season before Celtic had finished 8th in the league, and there wasn't a massive transformation. We talked about, he brought in Joe McBride and Bobby Murdoch. There wasn't a massive transformation in the team from a team that finished 8th in the league to a team that went on to win the league.
The other thing that's worth pointing out here as well is that Jimmy Johnson in the early days, didn't he always make the first team? There seems to have been a Jimmy was at a low ebb at that point, and I think Jock was having to build his confidence up. And as the 65-66 season progressed, we began to see the best of Jimmy Johnson. And I think the fans began to realise that here's a player that can really hit great heights. So Jinky didn't play, for example, in the 65 Cup final against Dunfermline for whatever reason. He just wasn't picked. And then early on in the 65, 66, he wasn't always there. But, you know, as the season moved on, he quickly became the player that we all hoped that he could be.
So, and I think the other thing statistically about that season, Harry, about the 65-66 season, was the first time we'd scored 100 league goals since before the Second World War in what had been traditionally a very high-scoring era for football in Scotland. And, you know, we scored 30 goals more than we scored the season before, you know, when Jimmy McGrory was the manager. So I think the style, the tactics, the man management, as St Anthony says, there was a couple of key moments of momentum that went with us, which gave us further confidence to kick on. But, you know, we really did start battering teams in the 65-66 season. And I mean, I think we got nearly 70 goals just in the home games in the league. So we were really taking teams apart, and something that Jock, you know, managed to engineer within a very, very short time as boss.
And as you said at the beginning, Santi, one of the keys behind that was sign of Joe McBride, who scored 43 goals that season. I think sometimes in Celtic's history, there are players that sadly get forgotten about. You know, if you look, Robert, you mentioned the 1966 England World Cup team, Jeff Hurst, and, you know, gets mentioned. The greatest striker in English football at the time was Jimmy Greaves, by a million miles. But he was injured, missed out, and his place in the pantheon of English football history for the non-avid football fans is sort of not quite where it should be. And you've got Joe McBride, who scored 43 goals in that season, and we'll talk about the following season in the next podcast, but, you know, I think injury curtailed his Celtic career, and then, you know, the luck that things happen the way they do.
It was a wee bit fortunate for Jock Stein, and as much as Joe did get the injury, because I think it was going to be hard for him to keep so many good players happy. Because in those days, we only had one substitute. So, I mean, if you've got a forward line that's like Johnson, what would that have been? Johnson, Lennox, McBride, Auld, Hughes,
Chalmers.
So you at any given time, you've got to leave one of them out. And Jock was very much horses for courses. He would look at the opposition. For example, that they always say that in a heavy, muddy day, then John Hughes was definitely going to play. And in firm ground, when it was dry, Bobby Lennox, for his pace. But I think when Joe got injured, and we're getting into the following season, obviously, he'd signed Willie Wallace at that point, and the reckon that the hope was that the partnership was going to be Willie Wallace and Joe McBride. And yet, it's funny how fate works out, because Stevie Chalmers got back into the team when Joe got injured, and it was Stevie who became forevermore the legend of the winning goal in Lisbon.
I think the good thing about Joe McBride is that, you know, post-Lisbon, and, you know, certainly in all the get-togethers and the anniversaries, and, you know, before Joe McBride passed away, he was very much valued by the Lisbon Lions as, you know, one of the crew, and, you know, somebody who had played a very important part in that period of success. And when he did leave Celtic in 1968, I think in the autumn of 68, he enjoyed a couple of great seasons with Hibs, scored a lot of goals. But as St Anthony's just said, there was a lot of competition. And by the time that Joe left, yeah, Willie Wallace was well established. And, you know, people like McCarry were starting to appear on the scene as well. So I guess he just couldn't give Joe McBride enough game time, but he, you know, he certainly enjoyed three or four good years with Hibs and Dunfermline, and I saw him play against Celtic probably more than I actually saw him play for Celtic, and he always got a fantastic reception when he came back to Parkhead to play for these other teams.
Do you know the other thing, looking back, given a wider context to the time, we look at the attendances of, 107,000 people were at that League Cup final. Interestingly, there was, in the Scottish Cup final, there was 126,000 at the first game and 98,000 at the replay that Celtic won. But if I go through, I can't find it to hand just now, but the interesting thing about league attendances during that time, we have this thing of 100,000 people were at this game and 100,000 people at that game. So the first Celtic Rangers game of the season that took place at Ibrox was attended by 76,000. But Rangers' first game of the season was at home to St Johnstone, attended by 22,000. And the Rangers game immediately following the Celtic game, the next Rangers game at home following the Celtic game, was against Stirling Albion, attended by 15,500. 19,000 when they played Dundee United. That if you scroll through, a big game was Dunfermline at 31,000. Most games were mid-20,000 people attending. Celtic Rangers games, 60,000, 70,000. But if you go through towards the end, 12,000 at home to Dundee, 19,000 Aberdeen, 11,000 at home to Motherwell, 10,000 for their final game of the season at home to Clyde.
I think there's a couple of reasons for that. I think the first one is that official attendances weren't really given in those days, so these were estimated attendances that all ended in three zeros.
No, actually, I'm looking through, every single one of them's an exact number.
Alright, because Celtic were notoriously...
I was going to say, but that's old board, wasn't it?
They're old board, so it's hard really to gauge the exact attendance at the time, but when you had boys getting lifts, when you had guys basically doing double shuffles at the turnstiles, and you had unscrupulous turnstile attendants that would let people in and pocket the money. But the other thing it's worth pointing out here is, again, going back to my listening to my dad through the years, there was a lot of what they call floating fans at the time. So it would be, for example, if Rangers and Stirling Albion wouldn't be a great attraction, therefore it would be the hardcore Rangers fans, just the same way as if Celtic played Hamilton Accies. But if Celtic were playing Hibs and Hibs were on a good run and it was maybe a nice spring day, then that could put 10, 15,000 on the gate quite easily, because you didn't need season tickets in those days. It was pay at the turnstiles. So it was almost like going to the pictures, if you like. You could make your mind up at short notice and say, about 2 o'clock, I think I'll go to the game today because it's a nice day, or the kids need something to do or whatever. So there was more of that, whereas these days, we are very season ticket orientated and we're regimented in what we do. You're going to go to every game. If you bought your season ticket, the chances of no going are pretty slight, because you wouldn't be wanting to waste your money. So that's probably part of the reason for that.
Yeah, it's just, it was, again, one of these things that people regularly think, because there was 100,000 at games at Hampden, then there would be an equal number at league games. But it wasn't quite. It was very different the way people attended league games, as you say. And also to give some context to it, to what Scottish football was like at the time. Celtic got, as we talked about, to the Cup Winners' Cup semi-final against Liverpool, unlucky to not get through. Dunfermline got to the Fairs Cup, through to, they get knocked out by Real Zaragoza. Hearts, they got knocked out the Fairs Cup by Valencia. Hibs got knocked out by Valencia earlier in the competition. And Kilmarnock got knocked out by Real Madrid of the European Cup. 2-2 at Rugby Park, and then 5-1 away at the Bernabeu Stadium. So gives you some context. Hibs and Kilmarnock didn't go past Christmas, but Hearts, Dunfermline and Celtic were all playing European football in March and April.
Mm-hmm. Who put Rangers out that season, Harry?
Well, do you know, that's just it. I am looking on Wikipedia, because I'm obviously not that interested in Rangers. I'm looking on Wikipedia for Scottish football season 65-66, right? Mm-hmm. Scottish clubs in Europe. Rangers are not listed.
No, they must have gotten to Europe.
No, I think they finished fifth in the league in the year that we finished eighth.
Yep.
They might not have been in Europe. They won the League Cup in that season, but the League Cup in that time was not a passport into Europe. It's possible they might not have been in Europe that season.
No, they weren't, because as you say, they were not doing so well in the league. Knocked out the Scottish Cup by Hibs in the quarterfinal the season before. They won the League Cup, but that didn't get you into Europe. The season before, they got to the quarterfinals of the European Cup, losing to Inter Milan. They lost 3-1 away and 1-0 at home, so the 3-2 in aggregate to Inter Milan. So, yeah.
I think it was a feature. It was a feature of our nine in a row that teams did well in Europe. I mean, during our nine in a row, Rangers reached two European finals, two European semi-finals, and at least one quarter-final. And as you've said, I mean, Dunfermline got to a Cup Winners' Cup semi-final. Dundee, Hibs, Kelly all had great runs in Europe. Kelly got to a semi-final as well. And that's, you know, a massive distinguishing feature with Rangers nine in a row in the 90s, when the Scottish team's record in Europe was almost abysmal across the board. The league was not as strong, and in many respects, you know, it was a very strong Scottish league in the late 60s, early 70s. And, you know, I think a number of clubs benefited from that when they played European games.
So we won the league, and Robert, you have a slightly, you have a better memory. Well, I wasn't alive, so you have a better memory than St. Anthony and I for this. Did you feel that something Celtic were on the verge of greatness, or was it just joy because that was the first time Celtic had won the league for 12 seasons?
Well, I barely remember the day itself, but, you know, I know my dad would have been hugely excited at winning the league. We won the league at Motherwell on the last game of the season, but I think we could have afforded to have lost the game by 3 or 4 goals and still won the league on goal average. I know that, you know, when my dad talked about that season, one of the things he talked about was beating Rangers 5-1 at Parkhead in the near-day fixture. Again, when Rangers scored in the first couple of minutes. And then, you know, we battered them after that, and Stevie Chalmers became one of the select few to ever score a hat-trick against Rangers. So, you know, we had great momentum, and you know, having read a lot about that season, you know, the joy on the terraces at Motherwell, I'm not sure what the crowd was for that game, but, you know, the joy was unbelievable. And, you know, just a slight regret that we, you know, we didn't then do Rangers in the Scottish Cup final and maybe get through to that Cup Winners' Cup final that we mentioned earlier. But, you know, the fact is we took two domestic trophies. It was fantastic progress in such a short space of time by Steen. And, you know, subsequently we went off on this long tour to the United States, which many people attribute the success of Lisbon season to, you know, what was achieved in that US trip and the bonding between the players and the management.
Yeah, to get back to your question, there was 21,000, according to Wikipedia, 21,234 people at the Celtic when Celtic won the league at Motherwell. The game before was a midweek game. We beat Dunfermline 2-1, and 27,000 people were there. There was 15,000 people at Capello, 24,000 people at Easter Road, and then 23,000 people at Celtic Park to see us beat St Mirren. So that was the sort of run-in to the season going in. So getting back to your point earlier, St Anthony, I remember speaking to someone who said, you know, sometimes they were from Dumbarton, and sometimes they would just go to Dumbarton games, or sometimes they would go to Celtic games. It was about just going to the nearest football game rather than... They were Celtic fans, but they went to the nearest football game rather than actually going up to Glasgow to go to Celtic Park all the time. So,
The other thing you've got to bear in mind here is that the conditions were very, very sparse for football fans in those days. So if you had a winter's day and it was really heavy rain or heavy sleet or heavy wind, then the chances are you'd be standing in an open terrace, open to the elements. So that isn't going to attract a lot of people in bad weather, whereas these days we enjoy comforts. But obviously we're fully roofed and you've got a seat and you've got, you know, reasonable conditions round about you. The other point I think is worth making here is, again, getting back to my dad's reminiscences, was the fact that we had a wee dodgy patch round about February, March 1966, whereby there was a controversial incident that we were on the way back from Russia, and we didn't get back till I think it was the early hours of Friday morning, but we were still required to go and play Hearts at Tynecastle on the Saturday, and we lost 3-2. Now, Celtic fans of my dad's generation always had a gripe against the SFA that game possibly should have been played because, you know, the legend has it that Jock Stein took the players back to Parkhead about 2 o'clock in the morning and made them go through a training session because he was worried about them stiffening up and the plane coming back for Russia. So you've got that controversial fact, and then I think we lost at Pittodrie, and we also had a crazy result, we lost to Stirling Albion at the old Anfield. So I think we made it harder for ourselves than it could have been. It could have been a wee bit easier if we hadn't had that wee run of away games that we were losing.
I see that. We lost 15th of January, we lost 3-1 to Aberdeen. We then beat Motherwell 1-0 away. Then, as you say, we were in Kiev on the 26th, which, you know, and we definitely would have, you know, travelling on those planes on the 27th or whenever it would have been. And then we played Hearts away on the 29th of January, lost 3-2. We then thumped Falkirk on the 12th of February, so a good 2-week break to play Falkirk. And then another 2-week break, and we lost 1-0 to Stirling Albion away.
What I'm told at that point, Harry, is that I think, although we played Kiev, it was the middle of January, you know, right in the Russian winter.
Yep.
So Kiev is out of bounds. I think they played it in Tbilisi.
That's right. There
was a big fear factor at the time after the Munich air disaster that you know, flying in snowy, icy weather wasn't the easiest way to travel in those days. And I think I might be wrong here, but I'm sure I've read in books that it was a pretty dodgy journey to get into the air and to get safely back to Glasgow. I think a lot of the players... That may have actually been the game that gave Jinky the fear of flying, because I think it was a pretty rough journey.
But we got through. I'm just having a look. You're right. The game was played in the Georgian city of Tbilisi as Kiev was snowbound in January. Celtic won 4-1 in aggregate. This is from the Celtic Wiki. Politics took hold of Celtic's first visit to Russia. Well, it wasn't Russia, it was the Soviet Union. Not being pedantic. This game was due to be played on the 20th of January, but Soviet authorities... again, they're calling it Russian. Soviet authorities refused to give Aer Lingus, the Irish national airline with whom Celtic had chartered, permission to fly directly into Tbilisi and wanted them to change at Moscow, as Ireland had no diplomatic relations with the Soviet Union and the Soviets had no diplomats in Dublin. Celtic secretary Desmond White informed UEFA that because of this, Celtic would not travel and the game was postponed. UEFA then rearranged the game for the 26th of January and permission was eventually granted for Celtic to travel via Vienna and Istanbul en route to Tbilisi. This was then rescinded with the flight having to go through Moscow. It took 31 hours of travelling for the team to arrive in the Georgian capital. The Celtic travelling party was the team that played, plus John Fallon, Ian Young, Charlie Gallagher, Bobby Lennox, Bertie Auld and Jim Brogan. Celtic packed a larder of food for travel for the first time. Bobby Murdoch had picked up an Enoch in the game before against Motherwell was in doubt, and the rest of the party trained. Murdoch received intensive physio in his knee. Celtic had travel difficulties on the route back and were diverted to Sweden. In Boma Airport in Stockholm, the plane failed mechanically at takeoff, leading to false rumours of a Munich-style disaster back in Glasgow. The team did not arrive back in Glasgow until the Friday morning, and Jock Steen took the team back to Celtic Park for a workout at 11 p.m. before they could go home, and 500 fans turned up to watch. So
That is a story,
and I don't think it's any surprise based on that story that Celtic lost 3-2 to Hearts the next day.
My dad's generation were very very upset at the SFA or the Scottish League, whoever the authorities, for making Celtic play that. They always thought it was a bit of a conspiracy that here's a chance to kick Celtic when they're down. Whether that's the case or not, I don't know, but it does seem a bit strange.
So this is Jim Craig's recollection of that trip. Sunday morning, 23rd of January 1966, leave Celtic Park by bus for Prestwick Airport. 12 noon, Aer Lingus plane takes off for Copenhagen, where we arrive at 1:30 p.m. 3:30 p.m. we depart for Moscow. Unfortunately, after a few minutes, there would appear to have been some problems showing up on the pilot's screen. Later rumours suggest that it was to do with the undercarriage, and it was announced over the speakers that we would circle the airport for a while to burn off fuel before landing. That would certainly be a good laxative. 6 p.m, we leave from Kastrup Airport again and eventually arrive in Moscow at 8:40 p.m. A bus takes us to our overnight hotel, the Metropole. We have a nice meal, thanks to our own chef and the food we took, before heading to bed. Monday, we have the chance to see around Moscow and take all the sights. It's bitterly cold. 12 noon, we head for the airport and board our plane for the flight to Tbilisi. We arrive late afternoon in the Georgian capital. Much to our delight, it is warm and sunny and the hotel is the Hotel Tbilisi. So that is the trip there. And as I say, coming back, it's no surprise that Celtic then lose to Hearts 3-2.
It must have been pretty scary in those days, though. I know we're a wee laugh here, but you know that the travel difficulties. But Munich in 1958 would have been fresh in the memory. And it must have been the aeroplanes in those days wouldn't have been as technical and it's probably the safety is much better now. And that must have, you know, I don't think there's any surprise actually that the likes of Jimmy Johnson would have been a wee bit terrified in future years of flying if he experienced that.
So as you said, Robert, Celtic tie up the title. It's the first title for 12 years. famously, Jimmy McGrory had said that they were all his boys. But unfortunately, he hadn't been able to create them into the team that Jock Steen had. And as the Lisbon Lions say themselves, it was a trip to America that happened that summer that they all put as the key point that really was the catalyst for 9 in a row and winning every trophy the following season.
Weird statistic which I saw on Wiki, and I found it hard to believe when I saw it, but the 65-66 season is the only season in the history of Scottish football where Celtic and Rangers have come first and second in all three domestic tournaments. I'd be happy if any of the listeners, you know, sends a note in to dispute that, but that was what I read earlier today. And I can't think of anything to dispute it, but it's quite an unusual fact.
That's a great stat. That's a great fact to end the podcast with.
So something just sprung to mind. The 71 season, we won the league in the Scottish Cup, and Derek Johnson scored the winner for Rangers in the League Cup final.
Yeah, but Aberdeen came second in the league.
Ah, good man, good man.
I looked at that one as well.
Well played, well played.
Wow, so if anybody has any, anybody's got anything that they want to add to counteract that fact of Roberts, get it to us, because the next podcast is going to be the 66-67 season. Anybody get any ideas what we might be talking about then?
The summer of love.
Exactly.
Winning the Glasgow Cup.
Yes, exactly. Well, I remember in 10 years later in 1986, winning the Glasgow Cup was the greatest thing, was the greatest trophy you could win. It's a vivid memory of mine. In the other half of the city, they were making a big deal of that. So, or 20 years later, I should say. So, anyway.
Well, Jim Spence on Twitter will always proudly tell you that Dundee United beat Celtic twice that season.
Of course. Oh, that was the Lisbon season, of course.
That was the Lisbon season, yeah.
Well, we can cover that in the Lisbon season. And with that, I will say, Robert and St Anthony, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Yeah, thank you. All right.
I hope you enjoyed that podcast. It's the start of the 9-0 Chronicles. Next season is obviously going to be the incredible 1966-67 season. Robinson, Anthony and myself will go through that. We'll go through the trophies. We'll go through the key moments. Anyway, enough of that. As I said earlier, wash your hands often and regularly. Don't let the confinement that UK listeners will be experiencing, or European listeners will be experiencing in particular, get you down. Try and get fresh air within the remits of what you're allowed, and stay safe. And this is me, Harry Brady, saying we'll get through this together. Next week is the 66-67 season. Good night and God bless. Oh, and that's Manfred Mann with Pretty Flamingo, the number one when Celtic clinched their first title in 12 years. Paradise is where I'll be. If she just would, some sweet day.